Hi, my name is Mandy Jackson Beverly, and I'm a bibliophile. Welcome to the bookshop. In the city of Guelph in Ontario, Canada, is a one-of-a-kind bookstore called The Bookshelf. A bookstore that shows movies, a cinema that serves dinner, a resto bar that launches books. This is a family-run business started in 1973 by Barb and Doug Minnett after visiting Britain and relishing all of the British bookstores. I caught up with Stephanie Minnett to find out more about this special place. Hi, Stephanie, and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Mandy.
It's lovely to have you here. Steph, you look like you're sitting in the middle of a jungle.
No, we have a living wall on our upper level. And the good news is that just before the pandemic started, we had done a huge renovation in our building to make our upper level accessible via elevator. And we did all of these beautiful renovations to make it inviting and lovely. And then this upper level with the e-bar and the cinema ended up not being able to be open. So I'm figuring every chance I get to use this space for something is...
I can see why. It looks really pretty. Now let's begin with the history of the bookshop and your part in it.
Sure. So it began in 1973 with my husband's parents, actually, Barb and Doug Minnett. And the two of them were young people who wanted to do something interesting and passionate and exciting and risky. So they got started doing a bookstore in Guelph. It's not at the location that we're at now, but their original location was smaller and a little simpler upstart. But then they had a change of heart and wanted to expand. And so they moved. And eventually we ended up in the location we're in now that has two floors. We expanded to a cinema included in 1989 and a little cafe bar that was attached to the cinema as well at that time. And then we moved our operation even further. There was a restaurant next to the bookstore that was part of our business, and the e-bar, which was officially a nightclub, that opened above the restaurant. And that was in the early 2000s. So it was quite a big operation. They didn't want to slow down. But it's a very interesting, exciting place. And it's been amazing to be part of. I didn't join the bookstore staff until 2008. For various reasons, I had other work that I was doing. And my mother-in-law, of course, was always like, "Are you sure you want to do this? You know what you're signing up for, right?" And I said, "No, I don't. But that seems to be kind of a thing around here."
Can you tell us about the family members who work there?
Absolutely. Barb and Doug again started it. And then my husband, Ben, and his sister, Hannah, took it over sort of around the time that I joined the staff. Barb and Doug has still operated in a mentoring capacity and still pitch in where and when they can and when they like to do so. Doug is a little more on the IT side of things. He actually has helped to form our website and to do our internal book management, which he's a data head. So that's kind of his area. And Barb has been more of a community influencer and a help in developing and maintaining relationships within our community.
And while we're talking about community, what are the demographics of Guelph?
Well, it's a very multifaceted city. We're kind of situated in the middle of a lot of other big metropolitan areas than Hamilton and Toronto. But we have in KW, our Kitchener-Waterloo. And in Guelph, we have the university, which has a huge impact on our overall culture, I believe. Interestingly, although it is certainly has lots of academia, one of the central studies at our university are agricultural and veterinary. So we have big colleges for people who are coming to learn how to grow and to create and to manage farms and to help with animals. And so those are two big components, but also a big artistic community, lots of musicians and creators and just lovely inspirations to like a cultural landscape.
So you have the creatives and also the intellectual community, which I'm sure is helpful in supporting not only the bookshop, but the movie theater and the restaurant.
Absolutely. Our movie theater is should be more a little more specific. It's more of a rep cinema, and it shows a lot of documentaries, a lot of Canadian produced content, a lot of art films, kind of those edgier, more challenging films, and very interesting avant-garde cinema. So it doesn't show that exclusively, but it certainly is not really into the blockbuster side of things or going for the big names necessarily, but more artistic. And the E-Bar, it's certainly has had that nightclub vibe, but we show a lot of live music. And we've also hosted drag shows and burlesque, and we get really, really interesting and fascinating people involved, which is terrific.
It sounds fantastic. And are you getting excited about reopening?
That will be a Monday reopen. So we have been, as I think everyone has been, on and off. We've done what we could. We've been able to do a lot of really great business through our bookstore during the pandemic. But we are looking forward very much to being able to be open to the public. Bookstores are so much a browsing sort of retail experience. It's not something you can duplicate on a website. We try, and yet, people are always saying, oh, I just want to come in and look at your shelves and see what you got. Because, and I'm, as the prime curator, I also feel, a little bit dejected when I know that people can't get the full effect of all of the different things that we try to bring in for people.
And do you mostly curate the children's section, or do you curate most of the bookshop?
I do all of the children's sections and also a lot of the adult curation as well.
That's a big job.
It is. And it's very exciting, though. I did certainly start with the children's section, and then it kind of evolved that I started taking on more. We have delegated some of the buying to other members of the staff, because it's really important to make both the staff and the customers feel like there's kind of a polyphonic experience when they're there. I certainly don't want to take over everything and have it all be Steph's store.
And I'm sure it's helpful having the input of your booksellers, too.
Absolutely.
Now, imagine you're a tour guide wanting to talk people into taking a tour of Guelph. How would you describe the city and surrounding area? And I was watching a video earlier about Guelph, and I was interested, do you know the age of your building?
Oh, gosh, that is a good question. I actually don't know how old our building is. The area we're in is the downtown core, and so most of the buildings in there are probably our century buildings or older. And certainly one of the more prominent architectural points of our downtown is the Church of Our Lady, which is a wonderfully large cathedral in the center of the city that can be seen from most points in the city, actually. It's quite a beautiful building. And so when people are first coming into Guelph, I always say, definitely wanted to check out the Civic Museum, which is down right next to the cathedral. The university has beautiful grounds, also very historic. We have some really beautiful green spaces to explore. I've got a dog, and we do a lot of hiking, and it's not hard. You don't have to go far to find a really nice trail right by the river.
And you're fairly close to Toronto, right?
We're about an hour.
So what is the geography like?
Well, we are certainly on the kind of like just on the tail end of the escarpment. So you do see quite a bit of, there is some exposed escarpment in our area, but certainly not on the same level as you would see in Hamilton or closer to the lakes. But we are, it's a kind of community, partly because we do have so much interest in natural green spaces, partly because of the university and all of the interest in plant life and botanical worlds, that we're definitely emphasize a lot of keeping as much green space as we can within the city bounds. So yeah, and as I mentioned, the Speed River, which runs right through, and the Aramasa River are two places that get a lot of traffic.
And in the winter, do you get much snow?
I would say we get some. We are, again, just below the snow belt. So the snow belt is, once you go a little further north, you get to road closures and that kind of thing.
It sounds like a great location.
Yeah, so we're right in the heart of just dodging that little bit.
Well, thank you for that. People like to hear a little about the areas where the bookshops are located. Let's get back to the bookshop. How was the attendance at the virtual events you've held over the past 16 months? And did it take a while to get into that groove?
Well, it was a really big one. I am the prime events coordinator, and I just started getting really into trying to stock, like get a lot of book things happening in the new space that we've been developing on the second floor. And I was so excited about it. And then the pandemic hit, and I kind of went through a little minor depression of going, oh, but it's not going to be the same. And it wasn't. And of course it's not. So I did certainly go through a period of trying to go, do I even want to do a virtual event? Can I, how am I going to duplicate the feeling of being in a space with people, talking about books, listening to someone read aloud, all those things that people love about our live events. But in the past few months, especially, we've gotten a lot of particularly local events that people have really latched onto, because I think it is something that even if you have to do it through a computer, people are feeling they really want to continue to participate in those things. And even if they're typing into a chat rather than raising their hand in a room, they like to be able to engage with people who are writing and creating interesting things.
I think more than anything, the virtual events were a real support for people living on their own and people who are lonely. I mean, we've had 16 months where a lot of people had to shield and they depended on virtual events as their way of communicating with people. When I think of a bookshop open every day before the pandemic, I think of people who used to just wander into these bookshops on their own and then maybe go and get a cup of coffee after they'd bought a magazine or a paper or a book and sit down and read. And when these bookshops closed and the coffee shops closed, they weren't able to do that. So having the virtual events, I think, has probably been a lifesaver for many.
Absolutely. And I think it can't be underestimated how much the idea of a virtual event opened up to people who could not attend a live event for other reasons, whether it be being out at a distance or accessibility or just a nervousness about crowds, like all the different things that keep people from participating. It give people, like in those positions, a free rein to say, oh, well, I can still be part of things. I just won't have to go out of my way and out of my comfort zone or put myself in a position where I have to try to navigate a set of stairs or, you know, all the different things that prevent people from participating. So it's been nice to know that they can be included and not feel like it's weird.
Yes, I completely agree. Just before you and I began our Zoom call, I was listening to the Village podcast that you co-host with Candace. Can you tell us about the podcast, please?
It's ongoing, and it was, again, something that I had to warm up to. Candace actually has much more experience, or was when I first started doing it, a podcaster than I was, and she approached us and said, you guys should have a podcast. And I go, ah, that sounds cool, but I don't know how to do that. And so we got started, and as I'm sure you know, you get started and you find actually there's a lot to talk about, and you can make it as specific and personal as you like. You can talk about bolder, broader topics that are coming up in the news. And I think a lot of people have really, again, connected, if they weren't already, with the ability to be able to hear a voice on the other end talking about culture, talking about a place that they know or would like to visit when things are more open. And it's just been another way for us to connect with people in our community and beyond.
And being a podcast host is a lot of fun because you get to meet wonderful guests. Now, everyone who shops at an indie bookshop knows that the most important people in that bookshop, apart from them, are actually the booksellers. So what can you tell me about your booksellers?
Sure. So I guess I'll start with my husband. And he's the president and does a lot of the marketing and organizing, kind of more on an external level, dealing with the Chamber of Commerce and talking with the city and managing the building. He's actually brought in some of his own interest to the business recently. And one would be disc golf. And we started carrying disc golf discs, which when we first brought them in, you know, a few of us raised eyebrows and go, how's this going to go? And he's just like, oh, no, don't worry. It's going to be huge. And it was. So that was one of his. He and my father-in-law also started contacting wineries and vineyards in the area and asking them if they'd be interested in selling their wine through our store. So that was something else we picked up over the course of the past 16 months. Our building is licensed because we do run a bar and a licensed cinema. So we were able to use that to our advantage and diversify a bit there.
Great idea.
Yeah, Barb is a very prolific reader. She loves especially espionage and a lot of literary fiction. And so she's always on top of the award nominees and finding out what the next big thing is going to be. She reads all the reviews and gets very keen on kind of like the new canon. Oh, and Lee Child.
Oh, yeah, what a surprise.
Of course. And then there's Hannah, my sister-in-law. And again, like a very diverse reader, loves lots of international fiction, really interested in all kinds of different genres, reads YA to kind of keep on top of things. She's got two teenagers at home. And so she's always trying to keep an ear to the ground about what younger people are reading or thinking about these days. So she's probably read all the Shadow and Bones before it was cool. And, you know, great. You know, it's nice to have somebody on staff that knows those things and is ahead of the curve.
Yeah.
We've got Catalina, who, in addition to being a DJ up in our nightclub, and at one point she ran our book club, she was doing some curating. And she's, again, like a very eclectic reader, loves a lot of genre fiction, and also gets into women's studies and political issues and very meaty essays and things like that, which is lovely. And then we have Pete. And Pete's big thing is he works on our games department, and he's brought in a whole bunch of different kinds of games and puzzles, which over the course of the pandemic, again, became a huge deal. We went from carrying like 5 or 6 jigsaws to becoming like jigsaw distributors. And so we got to keep on top of the stock. And I'm like, I know, do you have any more card games we can put out? Like, it was just wild, right? Everybody in exile and just in perpetual winter and or summer camp in their house, right? So it's just like, what are we going to do with ourselves? Escape rooms it is.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's been really on top of that. And let's see, Brad is, again, like, he's a musician, so he's much more interested in like cultural theory, and he likes reading bios and knows on kind of insider stuff about the indie music scene in Guelph, and has lots of friends who are involved in that. He's the kind of person you would find at the e-bar at the live shows, you know, until 2, which not all of us can do, but he will do it. And, you know, he's taking one for the team, and we appreciate that. So it's good to have people who are able to stay up late. I'm not there.
Yeah, I'm not there anymore either. And you have Andrew Hood.
So Andrew is he's an author, actually, and he's currently also doing he's gone back to school to do some more creative writing and work with, I believe it's Craig Davidson, on his next work. He's largely interested in short stories, short fiction, but he also delves into cultural theory and some other sorts of nonfiction interests. Big reader of George Saunders, Kurt Vonnegut, big admirer of like Alice Munro, like a lot of people who have made the short story and the idea of short concept fiction or weird fiction a thing. And so we often fight over ARCs. Or advanced reader copies. We get into, I remember one day specifically, I got this huge volume of Le Guin short stories. And I was like, okay, do I be a nice boss and hand this off to Andrew? Because I know he'll really appreciate it and probably pick it up tonight. Or do I take it home? And so I gave it to him. And then lo and behold, another copy came in. I'm like, somebody knew, somebody thought of me. So I was just like, excellent. But, you know, so we have science fiction and horror in common. And so it's always a little bit of a conversation there. Brian is our accountant, but he is Barb's partner, and he is also a prolific reader of all kinds of things. I'm always a little surprised by the things he's reading, because you never know. You think this person is into their 70s and now they've read it all, but I can tell him the weirdest book and he'll go, oh, that sounds interesting. And suddenly he'll be off to the races. And I'm like, wonderful. And big into cinema too, right? So both him and Barb are both very, you know, sad about the loss of the cinema for the time being. And so they're just like glutting themselves on Netflix and all of those, you know, they stay on top of the everything that would have played, I guess, at our cinema in the meantime, and the big readers about cinema and the next big thing in that world. So that's very interesting. Yeah.
And speaking of movies, do you have any kind of movie club, like you do a book club?
We certainly do largely pay-as-you-go, and we do offer a membership ourselves. Like the bookshelf has a membership, which does apply to the cinema, where you get a discounted admission price. But we also, in the past couple of years, we began to offer what we called the Sunday Cinema Series, or Sunday Secret Cinema. And that was a series of movies that were selected by our cinema manager that were not told to anyone. They were on a monthly basis. You show up on Sunday morning, you don't know what you're going to see. You sit down with your popcorn and just experience it. And then there's a discussion curated and explored by usually a special guest as well to talk about the movie and kind of unpack the process of the making of the film and the process of watching the film. So we had that. It became so popular, we ended up having to do a Sunday afternoon. And now, because we're still trying to grapple with what our reopening would look like, it's another one of those things that we think might work as another way to start. Because right now we're a small cinema. We're not a Galaxy or a big Cineplex.
And how many seats are there in the theater?
We have 170 seats.
That's a really nice size, kind of intimate for an independent kind of bohemian movie theater.
It's not tiny, but it is also like something where distancing is difficult and trying to make people feel safe and welcome, but also offer an experience that is somehow reflects what we would have had pre-pandemic is a tricky thing. And from a business standpoint, we certainly need to be able to have guaranteed numbers to justify being open at all. So having a secret cinema series or something mirroring that is actually probably one of our ideas is to sell advance tickets. Everyone comes on a prepaid set basis, and all sit and enjoy the show, and then have an opportunity to talk about it afterwards.
I think for many people, myself included, it's going to take a while for us all to feel safe and secure going back into the world again. I mean, we've had 16 months of mostly not going anywhere. And I'm speaking as one who's been vaccinated. I am wary and a little hesitant of going back out into the world again and being surrounded by people, strangers, who I don't know if they've been vaccinated or not.
You're right. I'm still waiting on my second dose. But even when I'm fully vaccinated, I don't know if I'm just going to be ripping that mask off and walking out into the world. Like, certainly not in my role in the store. Like, it would certainly not want to frighten anyone with that, with my face, which doesn't sound right. But
I know what you mean. I know.
But you don't want to see this. No, it's more just kind of like, just a matter of the kind of weird horror, though, that you feel when you see somebody, and you're at proximity without a mask on. Not just to think about the threat posed to you, but the threat that you have come to believe you might pose to someone else. I think there's a lot of reticence about that. And when you say, okay, so everyone go sit in this little dark room, which you actually both all really liked before, and munch away and be right close to each other and laugh out loud or gasp or all those reactions that involve breathing. It's like, how can we duplicate that experience in a way that doesn't make everyone look around and go, I don't feel like I should be in here?
Yeah, unless you have an outside garden area where you could hold evening movie showings, I can definitely understand why you'd want to hold off. Easing back into society again is just going to take time. I'm not rushing back, and most of my friends aren't rushing back either.
Right? That's exactly right. I mean, opening the store, we're going to be at limited capacity.
And that's at 15%, is that correct?
15%, yes. And all of our staff have had at least their first dose. So that is another comfort to us and to be able to say that to our public.
And kudos to you for mentioning this. I think it's an important subject that needs to be broached. As you said earlier, I'm still going to be wearing my mask for quite a while. But it's comforting to know that people who work in stores have been vaccinated. It's just comforting.
Yep, That's exactly right. Thank you.
Okay, your final question. What is one book you'd like to see more people reading?
So I was thinking about this question because there's so many books that I like to see people reading. But when I think about the kind of messages and the kind of things I think people need to hear and think about right now, the one that came to mind was called You and I Eat the Same. And it's a book of essays on food and the ways that food unites people and brings people together and show all the similarities between people rather than continually fixating on all the ways in which we could be divided. And when we see, it's so funny, as I was thinking about this, I thought, yeah, because all these patios are open and everyone's like booking them right away to get out there and all just kind of eat and be around each other. And I'm thinking to myself, yeah, like that is a very important thing. But this book is actually a selection of essays that focuses on the different ways that what people eat is the same in lots of different places, the way that food matters to people and means a lot to different communities, and also the ways in which new food is like new ideas. It takes a little while to adjust to, but over time you start to realize that you don't really want to live without something different. You actually want to embrace it and make it a part of who you are. And that if we think about how much the idea of a 4th of July celebration or a Canada celebration or a long weekend or whatever circumstances means to us right now and why it means so much to us, it's like universal. It's a universal feeling of wanting to say, I just want to sit and have a barbecue with you. Well, I'd be happy just to sit and have a cup of coffee with you. Or, oh, to share a pizza again, you know, wherever you, right, I'm sorry. But just like, I think that it's such a unifying factor. And if you think about that and you go, yeah, guys, wouldn't we all like to get there? Well, then we've got to do what we need to do to get there. Because if you're salivating and I'm thinking, oh, well, actually, I could have something too. And you're in California.
And I'm getting hungry.
And I'm in Guelph. And it's just like, I'm sure there's people all over the world who are thinking, connecting with food is such a, so everybody's thing.
I love that.
And what was the name of the book again, please?
So it's called You and I Eat the Same, and it's edited by Chris Ying, but it's a multi-voiced work. And it's everything from essays about how coffee is freedom to cultures in which trade is a challenge. All the way through to one essay is just a list of all of the weird things people eat. It is just a list. And then you go, you can pick out things in it that you're like, I would never, you know what, that actually wouldn't be bad. Or you find your weird thing on there amidst so many other people's strange and unexpected. And it's, I don't know, I just think it was a really important, insightful read. So I would recommend that one to anybody.
That book sounds like a winner. Before we sign off, Steph, can you just let people know where they can find the bookshelf?
Absolutely. So we can be found on the interweb at bookshelf.ca. From there, you can certainly click on an icon to find us on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram. And there's also, if you want to just look us up, we're at Bookshelf News. That's our Twitter handle. And if you are ever just in the area, we're at 41 Quebec Street in Guelph, Ontario. And you can also just give us a call and be glad to see you or hear from you.
Steph, thank you so much for chatting with me today. We've had a good giggle. And I wish you and every other indie bookshop owner and bookseller lucky enough to open today all the best.
Okay. Well, it was so nice talking with you. All right. Thanks so much for having me, Maddie.
Producing a podcast takes a lot of work, from researching guests, editing interviews, producing the show, and marketing. If you're enjoying the Bookshop Podcast, and I sure hope you are, here are a few ways you can support the ongoing episodes. You can subscribe to the show, leave a review, and share the link with family and friends and on social media. You can also support me by going to thebookshoppodcast.buzzsprout.com, click on the small orange heart at the top right-hand corner of the page, and donate using PayPal. Thanks in advance. Now, on with the second half of the show. Caitlin Hicks is a published writer of short stories, nonfiction, radio, theater, and film. One of her plays was adapted to a feature film called Singing the Bones and has screened around the world every year since its premiere at the Montreal World Film Festival in 2001. Her debut novel, A Theory of Expanded Love, was published in May 2015 by Light Messages Publishing in North Carolina. Hi, Caitlin, and welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Lovely to have you here. Your bio states, and I quote, "Born the sixth child in a family of 14 children, I was distinguished by my fair skin, small upper torso, and the nickname Skinny Malink, the graveyard dancer. As a child, my dog Lucky gave me needed one-on-one attention." End of quote. When I read these sentences, I had a lot of questions. So I figured it would be easier to ask you to share a few memories about where you grew up and how it was for you growing up with 13 siblings.
All right. Well, I was raised mostly in Pasadena, California. My father was he was in the Navy. So I was born in Texas and we lived in Philadelphia. Then we traveled over to Guam and then we moved back to Pasadena, California. And that's where I spent the years that I remember in my childhood. And well, we lived in La Cañada first, sorry, and then we moved to Pasadena. So it was Southern California, sunny days and warm. And we had a dog. Well, my dog Lucky, and we also had a dog named Divi when we were in La Cañada. I guess I didn't quote them. That was a joke because, like, in our family, just getting attention was a big thing.
Yeah, I can imagine it was.
Yeah, and I mean, I had a tendency to kind of be a fly on the wall, except when I needed something, and I ended up being sort of a target in terms of, you know, people being able to say things and I would be offended by them or hurt or whatever. You know, it's just pathetic when I think about it. But yeah, there is a whole ganging up that happens when you're in a big family. You have to learn how to speak fast and make your needs known. And, you know, you know you'll be cared for. I mean, that was a good thing. Our parents, you know, provided the food and clothing that we needed for sure. My father was in the service. My mother was also in the Navy. So there was a certain sense of, you know, being provided a standard issue piece of clothing, for instance.
I was wondering if you had to eat quickly, too. I guess there was no going back for seconds.
Oh, my goodness. The eating thing was ferocious in terms of just wanting to. I always remember being hungry when we sat down to eat and, you know, eating fast. There's a lot of noise going on and you just kind of like ate as quickly as you. I still do. I mean, I just wolf my food down. And then, you know, my husband was from a big family too. And what they did in their family was they threw for seconds. You know what I mean? Like their hands, they would go, how many, you know, what is it? 3, 2, 1. And then they'd open their palm. And I don't know if we did anything about seconds. I mean, if just, if there was anything left, you'd go for it, you know, but it was crazy. And, you know, I think I enjoyed my childhood more or less, but I remember being a kind of a teenager and ironing a blouse to go to school. And I had this thought at the time, I thought, you know what, if I had to do it again, if I had to be born again and become a child and a baby and get up to the here, would I do it again? And I said, no, I would not do it again. It's too painful. Yeah, I was just a teenager when I thought that. I thought I had a good childhood. And the way I got through it was being funny and stupid. I would do anything. I would lower myself to any level of hilarity and stupidity to make people laugh.
I read that you wrote plays for the entire family to perform.
That's right. They were mostly religious plays, you know, because we knew the script for those. We were reminded of that every single night and every weekend. So, you know, it was embedded, I'll tell you. Yeah.
Let's skip forward a few years. You graduated cum laude from Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles with a double major in French and English and an emphasis on writing. Such a gorgeous campus, by the way. Absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, I loved it. It was wonderful. It was a lovely situation. It's a beautiful campus. You're absolutely right. I really enjoyed, I used to dream about going back to college, you know, those halcyon days, you know what I mean? It's just, but really it was about being
that age, being young and being full of promise and, you know, ready to go into the world.
Where did you go after you graduated?
So after school, my first job out of school was for the Los Angeles Times. It was a summer job, and I was supposed to write camp fun stories, meaning they had this thing called camp funs. And I had to, and they would send people would send letters in and say, could you please take my child to camp this summer because we're disadvantaged in this and this and this way. So I would get these letters and have to create a character out of them for publication every day in the summer. So what I did was I used all the names of my brothers and sisters. I went through all those names as the people, because you couldn't use the right names, right? So they'd be looking for their name. You know, is it me today? Or, you know, and so that was kind of fun. And then after that, I went to work for Mattel Toy Company.
Was that at their offices in El Segundo?
In El Segundo, yeah, as an advertising copywriter. And because I got out of school and I thought, I want to be a writer, but I don't really know what kind of writer I want to be. Because you don't really have much life experience at that time. You don't know what to write. So I was open to writing anything. So I got a job as a copywriter for dolls in preschool. Things like, I guess the interesting anecdote about that one is just that there was an anatomically correct doll at the time. I guess that was a big, you know, thing that was going on.
Oh my gosh.
And what did you do after Mattel?
So I ended up moving to Northern California. My mother was sick. She had cancer. And I was just a young person, just not really knowing what to do. I broke up with a boyfriend, and my sister was living in San Francisco. So I figured I could move up there and I would have a pal. And I did freelance work until I started working for KCBS News Radio in their advertising and promotion department, which I really loved. It was it's a great little small world of people in media in San Francisco in those days. It was lovely. And then I went to work for KYUU as a manager of advertising and promotions. So I went from being, you know, just somebody as an assistant in a department to being the manager of advertising and promotions, which was wonderful for this new radio station that was NBC Radio.
So one day I got a call from these people at San Francisco Magazine who said,
your name has been going around our list, and we want to nominate you to be the most eligible bachelorette in San Francisco. And I said, well, I would love to do that, but does it matter that I'm married? She's like, yes, it does matter. So that was kind of a wake-up call for me.
Let's talk about your novel, A Theory of Expanded Love. It was a finalist in the Indie Fab Book of the Year Awards in two categories, religious and literary, and won first place Chanticleer Somerset Award. Here's the synopsis of the novel. Trapped in her enormous devout Catholic family in 1963, Annie creates a hilarious campaign of lies when the Pope dies and their family friend, Cardinal Stefanucci, is unexpectedly on the shortlist to be elected for the first American Pope. Driven to elevate her family to the holiest of holy rollers in the parish, Annie is tortured by her own dishonesty. But when the hands visit her in her bed, and when her sister finds herself facing a scandal, Annie discovers her parents will do almost anything to uphold the reputation and keep their secret safe. Questioning all she has believed and torn between her own gut instinct and years of Catholic guilt, Annie takes courageous risks to wrest salvation from the tragic sequence of events set in motion by her parents' betrayal. Caitlin, did you draw from your childhood for this book?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I guess the way I look at it is everything that happened in the book is exaggerated or made up, but it's authentic because all the details surrounding it, the atmosphere, the whole environment, the world of my childhood is known and communicated through the details that surround the things that happen in that book. So my little brother, Andrew, read it. So here I am, number six in the family, which Annie is also. And five kids in between me and this brother that I'm talking about. So he's quite a bit younger as far as it goes in a big family. And he goes, oh, I'm so glad to have read that book. I had no idea all those things happened before I was born. And I said, they didn't. I made them all up. And I mean, things I didn't make up but I recreated were things, it's funny because my husband's from a big family too. And these are things that happened in both of our families. They're just so common. Things like getting left behind on a family trip. You know, the parents drive off without you.
Oh, no.
And then finding you, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, I would have that kind of thing happen. I had a dog, so the dog is in the book, you know, that kind of thing. I took ballet lessons, so the ballet lessons are in there, you know, that sort of thing. But I was never as smart as Annie was at the time. I feel like I was totally clueless. I just walked around with my mouth open, you know, watching things.
And what about the Catholic guilt? Is that ongoing?
Well, I think it's just embedded. I think it's just a natural thing about it. They want you to be this way and you're going to fall short, right? Because it's some model of perfection. So in between that, what your behavior is and what the expectations are.
In your bio, you write, "My path as a writer has always been a personal spiritual journey, although my work is not religious. I am drawn towards stories that I don't hear often in the mainstream culture. Often I begin writing because I need to explore something that cannot be said. I enjoy bringing life to personal, pivotal stories, which have the kernel of transformation and which will connect us all to each other." When you say to explore something that cannot be said, are you referring to subject matter that is often swept under the mat, or rather personal stories buried in our psyche?
I don't know if I separate those two things, but I think my work was the stuff that I was most passionate about and that had to write, you know, that wrote itself in a way. It's something that where I can clearly feel the character is bristling against the ability to express what is really there. Now, that has a parallel with Catholicism because there's all of this show in Catholicism and ceremony and the repetition of what your beliefs are so that you won't forget. And in case you see something that's not quite like that, human life, you know, human nature, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so a lot of editing going on here. I think that my characters are driven by the desire to speak what cannot be said. And that's the thing that just really energizes me when I get to a situation. And I think it comes from my childhood because, you know, you're drowned out by all the other voices yelling loudly about this. And if it's the generally recognized as safe belief that everybody has, you're never going to get a chance to say something different unless you go outside and write your own thing. So as an example, I'll just tell you in my novel, The Theory of Expanded Love, one of the plays I wrote called Six Palm Trees was performed. We toured it hundreds of times around. We went to California. We went across Canada. We did lots of different places. Anyway, but by the time I got it to my family and I had told them that I'd written this comedy about life in a big family, it was kind of a stand-up comedy routine. And the premise was that the main character was Annie Shea again, right? Same character, who was the family clown. And the situation of the play was that they're selling the house after having lived there for 26 years. And they're getting together for one last family reunion. And Annie is the entertainment at the family reunion. So everybody in the audience is family. So when we toured this, I would pick out people from the audience to be the different brothers and sisters. And at the end of the play, everybody would say, okay, let me name everybody. So the audience would name everybody in the family. So they got to know the whole family. But it was a stand-up comedy thing. And it was hilarious. And I worked it to the point where it was quite funny. But it does go down this path. And again, this is the path of speaking what cannot be said. And the path was that the mother had died, which our mother had died, and my husband's mother had died. And what had happened to her to make her die before all of us? So the character looks at her body and how it is broken down by the birth of all these children. You know, the varicose veins, saggy gut. And so in the play, after everybody's just laughing and hooting and isn't this funny? I mean, all the stupid jokes about how many there were and just making fun of everybody and everybody's laughing. And it was wonderful. Well, before we did the play, I said to Gordon, what about the part? where she gets mad at the dad. What about that? What are we going to do about that part? How can we perform that part in front of the family? And it was like 10 minutes before showtime. We hadn't thought of this. And all of a sudden, we're like, what am I going to do? This is outrageous. It's just like, and I totally speak what cannot be said in that play at that point in the thing. And I just thought, well, I don't know. It's not a play if I don't do that. It's just, you know, what is it? So I did it. But my dad left the room before I got to the thing. And the whole room was just silent. And like, oh, what did she just say? Anyway, so then my father dies a few years later and disinherits me from his will. And I hear from the other brothers and sisters that it's because of this play that, that I wrote. And in looking at that experience, another sister also got disinherited because she was an artist and because she didn't believe in Catholicism anymore. We were talking to each other and I had a dream about the house we lived in as children. And Mary, I told my sister about this and she said, you know what, that dream points to the fact that the story of our family is your inheritance.
Your sister sounds like a smart lady. And Caitlin, you were just giving us a little bit of the background for your theater work, which I know is important to you and a big part of your life. When did this part of your life start to develop?
Well, I dropped out of the corporate world, just realized it wasn't right for me. I wanted to be the person that I was promoting. I was in the promotions department, so I was promoting the on-air talent, and I wanted to be that talent. So I quit and became an actress and started to study to become an actress. My husband and I were in counseling, basically. You know, I met my future husband, basically, in an improv class. And it's a long story or a short story, but it's not relevant necessarily here. My husband and I split up. I met Gord and really felt a connection with him, a super strong, like from the ages, you know, like from other lives or something. I just had to be with him. So I married my first husband because my father found out that we were living together. And that's not a reason to get married. It was a Catholic reason, but it wasn't the right reason to be with somebody, you know. So, and then I look back on all that stuff that I did within the family, trying to conform, trying to be the person they wanted me to be. And Gord, you know, of course, he's Canadian, right? He lives in Canada. And we went to New York together, you know, because I was an actress and I wanted to give that a try. And he was an illustrator and wanted to, you know, make connections there. And we were there for a short period of time. And he got a commission in Toronto. So we moved to Toronto and I was like, oh, I love this place, Canada. Let's live here. So now I live in Canada and I'm far away from my family of origin. And every once in a while, I go back and I dip my toe in being a part of who they are. And I always pull my toe back out. Because I couldn't live, my soul couldn't live in their presence, having to do what they expect me to do and be.
Yeah, I understand. Now, can you tell us about your play, Singing the Bones, and how the film version came to be?
The play is a journey of three women towards the birth of a child, the mother, the midwife, and the obstetrician. It basically takes the life stories and the intimate stories that each woman has and brings to this birth. And the birth is the catalyst for all of them revealing these stories and learning what to do in the course of that birth. So the mother has already given birth twice before and had very traumatic experiences in the hospital and does not want to go to the hospital at all. But she's pregnant with twins, which is considered a high-risk birth. The play was written in the mid-90s when midwifery was still illegal in British Columbia and across Canada. I had written sort of a play with these characters talking about these things that were disturbing. And I called it Plutonium in Space. And I had a workshop of this play. And it was so dark that I couldn't continue writing it. And I don't know what attracted me to those things. But, you know, at one point, I guess I was sitting at a desk trying to write. And I felt something kind of drop into me. And I wrote this story. And I didn't know if it was a good story or not. So I researched it. And then when we moved out to the Sunshine Coast, I was like, well, what do I do with this play? It's just so dark. I can't, you know, I can't move on with this. And my husband said, why don't you just write about birth? That's all you think and talk about. You're just interested in birth. You know, that's what you like. So just write about birth. So there was a midwife that I knew, and I began speaking to her, and she was super eloquent and spiritual and beautiful. And she honored the mothers, and she felt their strength, and she felt their power. And she wasn't in the system of the medical, modern medicine. So some of her stories were so, they were just so inspirational. I had to put them in. So I created the characters. I created the conflict. And so I created the situation of the birth with the mother, the midwife, and the obstetrician. So each person has their own story that they bring to this birth. It's suspenseful in the sense, what is the mother going to do? And I did a lot of research about the complications that come up as a result of twins, and how safe would that be? And then we balance that off against the mother's wishes and her traumas. And I remember the first performance of it. It was packed, and it was in the round. I was in the center, and everybody was around me. It was beautiful. And it was the first time I didn't know if the play was good. You know, you never know if it's any good. And I performed it, and you know, the lights went down, and then they went up. Everybody was standing, just wildly applauding me, which was so fun. I am such a basket case.
Reliving moments like the one you've just shared can be extremely emotional.
Yeah, it was so amazing because I was like, I guess it's good. I guess it's okay.
And the show has had great reviews.
Oh, absolutely. And I miss touring with that whole group of people. It's like, as a professional actor and theater producer, you have letters of agreement with people just to make sure you're all on the same page. And I didn't need a letter of agreement with any of those women. You know, I didn't. Everyone was so wonderful. And all the best things about people came out every time I did that play, when we toured and everything like that.
And then how did the play become a film?
Well, we decided to make it into a movie. It was the end of the tour, and I was quite exhausted because it's quite an exhausting journey, all three characters, just very emotionally rich. And I was like, you know what? I've done this play like hundreds of times, and I'm done with it. I'm like, let's just, can we like preserve it somehow? So we made a film out of it, and my husband edited it. And I remember at the end of the editing, I was like, the first edit, I was like, this doesn't work. This film is like, you know, it's like, it's not a film. It's just a play. It's just like, what are we going to do? And we just looked at each other with our hearts sinking, you know. And then he edited it again and again. And it worked. And it's so much, you know, it was just, it worked. I was proud of it.
And for anyone who'd like to hear pieces that you've written, they can go to your podcast. And I'll be sure to put the link in the show notes. But what's the name of your podcast?
It's called Some Kind of Woman, Stories of Us. So I just looked at the work that I had created over my career as a writer, performer, playwright, author. And I thought, you know, and most of all my characters were in the first person because of my theatrical background. And I had to perform the plays, and I performed them as the characters. And I had a few accents and, you know, characters that allowed me to be freer than other characters. And so I thought, why not do this? Let's do short monologues.
Yeah, it's a great little show, and I highly recommend it. Now, what are you currently working on?
Well, I've actually written a second novel called Kennedy Girl, which follows on A Theory of Expanded Love. And I'm looking for a publisher for that because I don't want to publish it myself. And what I thought I would try to do is get the rights for both of them so that I could offer that. Because in Canada, my A Theory of Expanded Love really was not seen at all because it was not published by a Canadian publisher. And there's so many perks and tax incentives and prizes, and the whole industry is geared towards writers who are published with Canadian publishers. So because I was published by a US publisher, and very successfully so, iBooks Best New Fiction is not something to shake your, you know what I mean? I'm so proud of that. That's an international win. But in Canada, nobody cared. So I thought I would get the rights back. And so I did. so that I could try to get a Canadian publisher to publish it.
Well, I hope you get a publisher very soon. Now, what is one book, apart from one of your own, you'd like to see more people reading?
Migrations.
It's a book by Charlotte McConaughey. I felt like that book was so much about all of what we have as people who live in the world, you know, and it's where we came from. It's all being lost. And we don't really see it necessarily, but we keep hearing it. And maybe we see it in little ways, but this book, she's on a trip to following the last migration of this particular kind of bird, some kind of a seagull tern or something. And it's just infused with the sense of loss and emotion and beauty. And it's just like, I practically cried through the whole book. It was just so beautiful.
That sounds like a wonderful read. And Caitlin, thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah, it's been fun speaking with you. And I mean, I've got questions for you.
Well, hang on. Let me say goodbye and I'll answer your questions. Make sure to follow me on Instagram and Facebook at The Bookshop Podcast. To learn more about upcoming speaking engagements, my books, and my Art of Observing workshops, go to my website at mandyjacksonbeverly.com. You can sign up for my newsletter or contact me directly at mandy@cricketpublishing.org and follow me on social media at Mandy Jackson Beverly. Read global, buy local, support your local indie bookshop.